Welcome to the Reason Roundtable, the weekly news and commentary podcast from your magazine of free minds and free markets. I am Matt Welsh, joined by Nick Gillespie, Peter Suderman, and Catherine Mangieu Ward. A beautiful fall day to you all.
Howdy.
Hi, Matt.
Happy Tuesday.
We are going to talk in a moment about the upcoming anniversary of September 11th, but first, data privacy is now finally in your hands. Introducing Secure, the instant messaging and email platform hosted in Switzerland. By using military-grade encryption methods, a proprietary platform, and servers hosted in Switzerland, Secure protects your data from various intrusive governments and laws. Featuring 100% homegrown technology, zero affiliation with big tech giants like Amazon, Google, or Microsoft, Secure is the choice for privacy enthusiasts worldwide. Make the move to Secure by visiting secure.com. That's S-E-K-U-R.com. Do it today. You'll be glad you did. Okay, it was 20 years ago this coming Saturday morning when 19 terrorists hijacked four planes in the American Northeast, steering two of them into New York's World Trade Center Twin Towers, another into the Pentagon, while the fourth was re-seized by passengers and crashed into a Pennsylvania field. 3,000 people were killed that day. The 9/11 attacks changed America in many lasting ways. It's why you take off your shoes at the airport. It's why there's such a thing as the Department of Homeland Security. And it's largely why the United States conducted a disastrous and destabilizing war in Iraq, even though that miserable country had nothing to do with the attacks on that dreadful day. We're going to get into some of those redirections of American policy here in a bit. But first, just to wrap our heads around the enormity of that day, I wanted to talk about how it affected each of us personally. Catherine, how, if at all, frankly, did 9/11 change the trajectory of the happy young yachting life of Lil Mangieu?
So I will say my 9/11 story is the dumbest 9/11 story because I was in college at the time. So you know how it is when you're on a college campus and the real world just isn't very real to you. And I absolutely sat through an hour lecture about Beowulf, like during 9/11. Like it had already happened, but I had rolled out of bed and gone straight to class. And the professor was like, "It appears something bad occurred, but I'm going to do my lecture on Beowulf." And that's how I spent the morning of 9/11. But I will say, for me, the main upshot of 9/11 was that history unended. I mean, I was in college at a time when there was really nothing to get so terribly upset about. You know, people were like a sort of annoyed about sweatshops a little.
That didn't stop people from getting really annoyed about a lot of things. It was different for sure.
I would say that, you know, growing up in Washington, D.C., politics was the background noise of my life, but it felt like it didn't matter at all. And I think that's because in the mid-late 90s, it really didn't matter at all. And, you know, college exacerbated that. And it was this moment that suddenly all the stakes went up. And I think that was like a gradually dawning realization for me because I was still insulated. But the experience of being on a campus in the late 90s, pre-9/11, was absolutely one of just being like, I guess the world is fine and like, you know, massive global conflict is over. And that kind of felt like a true thing. And it turned out not a true thing.
Suderman, you're basically the same age as Catherine, similar Beowulfing.
I was also in college and the immediate sort of impact on my life was that the RA on my hall came in and said, "Hey, somebody maybe crashed a little plane into the World Trade Center," which I vaguely sort of understood was a tall building in New York. And so it got me finally, after like weeks of being in the dorms already, to hook up my cable system, which I had not yet done because all I was watching.
I love it that your 9/11 story is a story of AV setup.
Yeah, I mean, because we'd only been watching movies until then. But, you know, I actually want to talk about sort of one of the kind of consequences for me personally after that. And so you mentioned, Matt, right, the one of the direct sort of outgrowths of 9/11 was the war in Iraq. It was the second one, and I had already been through one of those already during the first Gulf War, right? I was a kid living in a military community near a big Air Force base in Florida, and the war at the first one actually hit pretty close to home in a lot of ways. I mean, literally, after the bombings started during the first Gulf War in the early 1990s, one of the local newspapers printed up a map of targets that had been struck by Allied forces. And kids in my class would go up to this map, which had been posted at the front of the classroom next to the chalkboard back when we still had chalkboards. And they would talk about which ones their dads had been involved in hitting, right? So it was, the war effort was something that was very sort of close to me in reality. And it was sort of omnipresent. And growing up in a military community, I came out with what I think is sort of a reasonably common impression for people who grow up in places like that, which was that folks in the military basically know what they're doing. Sure, there's a lot of bureaucracy. There's a lot of decision-making bloat. Like, ask any, you know, sort of a lifetime service member about decision-making in the military, whatever service branch they're in. They will have great stories and jokes about it. But service members themselves are really quite competent and efficient. And this was my impression. And you know, they're planners and they're doers. And so I'd basically just come to assume that they all knew what they were doing and you could pretty much trust them. So when the second Gulf War rolled around and there were all these questions about whether Saddam was directly connected to 9/11, about whether he had weapons of mass destruction, whether Iraq was a direct threat, you know, it was a war effort, again, of the kind that I was in some ways familiar with. And I assumed that the folks in charge, the people at the very top, you know, all the way up the flagpole, I assumed that they knew what they were doing and that they were basically competent and basically being truthful with all of us. And the ensuing war just really disabused me of that notion. And, you know, it wasn't that I was wrong, I think, on average, to trust that individual service members, all the guys who I grew up with in the military base, it wasn't that they didn't know what they were doing. The troops, the pilots, the resource supply guys, the engineers, those guys, in fact, on average, really quite competent. They are the planners and doers that I thought they were. But the political control apparatus, which in the case of the second Iraq War was the George W. Bush White House, was just deeply incompetent. And the prosecution of the war was just handled incredibly badly, especially in the first few years. And it's not just that they were incompetent, though. They were also deeply deluded and deeply convinced of their own rightness and moral superiority. And because of that, they made a lot of terrible decisions that cost thousands of lives. They lied to people. They lied to the public about the war, about all the decisions and facts leading up to the war, the aims and goals, just the whole thing. There were just so many lies. You know, and some people tried to argue this was some like unique aspect of the Bush White House. And there were ways that it was kind of specifically unique to the Bush White House. But over time, I guess I sort of came to realize that this was just a feature of politics and politicians and groups of people vying for political power. Politics isn't noble, right? It's a system of lying people in order to gain and hold, lying to people in order to gain and hold political power. And so it's not the most important consequence by any means, but 9/11 and the aftermath of 9/11, I think, was what really taught me to distrust the government and to distrust politics and to distrust politicians.
And to start drinking. Nick, speaking of starting to drink, you were the freshly...
I'm already done, Matt.
Yeah. you had just been named editor-in-chief, right? Like you were within your first year or so at
Two
the
years.
Helm of this great...
Plus the second year. But yeah, I mean, it. You know, one of the... There's a lot of different ways to think about 9/11 and its effects. In a lot of ways, I think its longer-term effects are relatively minor on the day-to-day lives of most people because, you know, if we're being honest, there was about a 15-minute period where Americans and even Europeans were, you know, were all New Yorkers for about 15 minutes. And it's kind of fascinating to think about the mythography, the mythology of 9/11. It really centers around the Twin Towers and New York City being attacked. You know, weirdly, nobody cares about the Pentagon. Fewer people care still about the field in Pennsylvania, which effectively ended the threat of airplanes being used as terrorist weapons when people on United Flight 93 stormed the cockpit and drove the plane into the ground. You know, by like 10 a.m. on 9/11, we never had to worry about airplanes being used as missiles against civilians again. Which is kind of fascinating. And that's a lesson that we should have learned, because we could have obviated a lot of war on terror bullshit, like you were alluding to at the beginning, you know, about TSA and things like that. We had ways to deal with terrorism that did not mean completely reorganizing everyday aspects of life. But what I, drawing on something Catherine was getting at, it's, I think the big effect, and this was certainly true, you know, just as the editor of Reason, there was this brutal reinsertion into, you know, what was called history. After the collapse of the Soviet Union, Francis Fukuyama famously wrote his End of History and The Last Man essays, which, you know, kind of summed up this idea that, you know, we had reached this threshold, this plateau, where we had reached a kind of promised land in world history and global history, that representative liberal democracy had won a kind of existential battle, a twilight struggle, and that was going to be the future was going to be how do we create meaning in a world where global conflict is rare, where it is not particularly threatening to people outside of, you know, these small skirmishes showing up on the globe. And what do you do when you have a population where wealth and income and the ability to choose among different means of being, you know, is just growing and growing? And it turns out in the 90s, we did not really grapple with the implications of that. And how do we build institutions? How do we build societies? How do we build personal psychologies and kind of mindsets to deal with that? And as a result, I think that, you know, the real effect of 9/11 was that it allowed people who did not want to give up on a kind of Cold War mentality or a struggle mentality, a very 20th century mentality where there were large powers of good and evil in the world, figured in nations or in whole systems of organization of society and economy and culture. People didn't want to give up on that because it was kind of shitty, to be quite honest. It meant you were regimented. In order to fight the Soviets, you kind of had to be the Soviets on some level. And like put your individualism to the side while you did something for a collective good, you know, on all sorts of levels. A lot of people really wanted to go back to that mindset. And that's what we did after 9/11. And that's the real lingering effect, because it turns out Islamo-terrorism, Islamo-fascism, you know, radical Islam is not an existential threat to the world we live in. I think it was... V.S. Naipaul, who said, you know, he didn't fear, who knew a lot about Muslims, being one himself raised one and studying them. He said he didn't fear the 9/11 terrorists because they could fly planes into buildings, but they couldn't build either planes or buildings. And we made a major detour, which has sucked up so much energy and so much time of the past 20 years. And now as the war on terror is ending, because, you know, we're out of Afghanistan and people realize we went down a dead end for the past 20 years. Now we're ready to do the same thing, but with COVID and then a little bit of China and Russia on the side in order to keep this kind of threat level up there and regimenting every aspect of our lives. And that's, I think this is the lesson we need to unlearn. And kind of get back to a place where, you know what, we live in a world where people are getting richer, things are generally more peaceful, everything can go in a good direction where more and more people are able to create the lives that they want. Unless we say, no, we have to subjugate everything in the name of this great God of anti-terrorism, anti-COVID, anti-China, anti-Russia, et cetera.
There is a building on that. There, a lot of people point to the late 1990s efforts by a lot of neoconservatives, which was a thing that actually existed, a category that actually existed back then, much less so today, to do the project for a new American century, which was focused on the threat of Iraq and Saddam Hussein, and to, you know, vow to help free the Kurds and to do this and that. And that's true. All that happened. But as much as anything, and this is something that came to the fore when I was working on my article and then book about John McCain, is that beginning in 1997, there was this whole idea cooked up by David Brooks and Bill Kristol and others about national greatness conservatism. And a deep cut for those who want to go look at that is that Virginia Postrel, then the editor of Reason, wrote a really great kind of rebuttal to that in real time. I think their first essay was in September of 1997. And she identified many of the things that Nick just talked about. Like, they're just going in search of meaning, and they need to kind of collectivize all of us. And what I want to emphasize about that and reading about all of those kind of exertions is that Iraq was not a huge part of it. It was a lot about China. It was a lot about North Korea. It was a lot just we don't even know what the thing is, but we need to rally ourselves to go after the thing in order, I mean, very consciously to create that meaning in our lives. And I think the people to this day, the people who helped whip that up have not revisited that as a bad concept and their role in it in ways that could be useful. Catherine, what are some other ways in which you have seen the 9/11 world that we live in redirect policy, change the way that we look at specific things?
Yeah, I actually wanted to just kind of jump on what you said, because I, of course, immediately after 9/11 graduated and went to work for the Weekly Standard, where all those guys were in the middle of really doing this American Greatness Project, and also in the middle of transitioning from having this boogeyman of China and also maybe like genetic engineering, and like there was sort of a cluster of things that were undermining American greatness.
There was like a whole George W. Bush speech that I assume was written out of an office next to where you were an assistant.
Yeah,
somewhere.
The Project for American
about like the danger of human animal chimeras.
Yes, this was what was his name? Cohen. He like would write these regular things for the Weekly Standard that were basically
Leon
just,
Cass, perhaps
not Leon Cass. I think Eric. Can't Eric?
Oh,
Cohen?
Yeah.
I can't remember his
head
but,
of ethics and public policy.
Yeah. So, but there was this interesting bridge moment that I kind of stepped into where people were trying to make connections between the kind of Islamic terror stuff and the previous anti-China stuff, and so Uyghurs became like a very confusing topic for that crew, because it was like these were sort of oppressed Muslims that the anti-China neocons had been sticking up for, but now maybe Muslims are bad, and so we don't know. And so I remember there being like tension about the Uyghur coverage as they tried to work their way through. And also that there was, Francis Fukuyama was part of that crowd, and this idea that it turned out we weren't at the end of history, and that actually the last man was, I guess, like not lurking around the corner as we thought, or maybe the last man turned out not to be Chinese, or maybe like there was just this really, really interesting and like surprisingly generative moment where this whole movement of genuinely smart and well-intentioned people, I know it's like, oh, we hate the neocons, but these were people who were really trying to figure things out and all were also trying to pivot into a world, you know, that they didn't know a lot about. The Middle East was just not an area of deep knowledge. People were either Chinese experts or sort of ye olde Russian experts who were still looking for their next thing. But in terms of big policy changes, I just want to flag for podcast listeners that the next issue of the magazine will be a cover story by Brian Doherty about the anniversary of the Patriot Act, which is, of course, the biggest, most immediate thing to come out of 9/11. And the end of privacy that came with that. And Brian, because Brian is a historically literate and subtle thinker, points out that a lot of the things in the Patriot Act were already, they were just incremental changes. Like that it was a shift in thinking, but that already so many of the protections on our privacy had been eroded. And at the time when Hawks said, well, this isn't that big a deal, in a weird way, that was true. But also that once the kind of new mental framework of the Patriot Act was put in place, that the idea that the Fourth Amendment was kind of an inconvenience in pursuit of the war on terror, and that the distinction between citizens and non-citizens was, you know, a technical one and not as vital as previously believed. That was a real sea change in that moment. And so I think just like the Patriot Act as a permanent part of our lives and the sense that privacy was over, while it wasn't actually totally really over in a completely novel way in that moment, it was importantly altered and a new framework was put in place that has only grown in the 20 years since.
Peter, do you think that there's also been pressure put on the First Amendment, or at least the, by the practitioners, people who are in the First Amendment business since 9/11?
Well, I certainly think there have been changes to the way that news coverage has evolved in the aftermath of 9/11, but also literally starting that day. And so this is just something that I have a really strong memory of that I think sort of younger listeners might not really quite realize, is that suddenly on the morning of September 11th, 2001, news volume and news intensity just radically increased in the space of like a couple of minutes. There was so much happening, or maybe happening, and people didn't know. I mean, do you guys remember there were just like reports on CNN of truck bombs and additional attacks and a zillion statements from every important and unimportant official in the Western world, and just all of this sort of stuff happening all at once? And so as a result, the presentation of the news changed too, almost immediately. And so we talk about the news cycle. You guys have all heard that term a million times before. But in the old days, like back when, you know, Catherine and I were in high school or elementary school in the 80s and 90s, the news cycle was an actual thing that sort of had different components as it rolled out during the day. There was evening news, there was late night news, there was morning news, but there were breaks and there was regularity. And it would be sort of that you, if you were a politician or somebody who's trying to make news and make a news event happen, or even if you were a journalist, you would sort of understand that, okay, the next time we're going to roll out news and the news cycle will be on the 4 p.m. hour, right? That's when it's going to happen, or in the morning paper, whatever it is. And then suddenly 9/11 happened, and it was the biggest possible news event. There was genuinely too much information. You could not process all of it in orderly, discrete chunks that came out, you know, every 3 to 6 hours. It was just a flood. And so cable news started presenting things differently. And they started presenting news all day long in these tiny little disconnected fragments, often devoid of context and often in parallel. So the clearest and thing that happened as a result of 9/11 just to the news was the scroll. And this was like a new innovation. It used to be that the Chyron just sort of said in 3 to 5 words a summary of what the anchor was already saying. And that was it. That was the only additional piece of information on the screen. So it was a guy's face or a lady's face and a Chyron that summarized what they were saying, and maybe the name of the channel and the time, something like that. And now we have these cable news feeds that are just sort of look hilariously overstuffed, right? There's 74 different pieces of information. You can't process all of it. And then, of course, we all also have all of this stuff online, which is what cable news is competing with. We have Twitter and we have Facebook and we have, 10,000 different tabs open. And, you know, in some ways, this made sense during 9/11, and there was call for it, right, to sort of figure out ways to present a lot more volume of information very rapidly. But that kind of intensity and volume of information presentation has persisted ever since. And if anything, I think it's become a lot more intense, often with less and less actual news. And you guys talked about meaning creation just a couple of minutes ago, and it does really seem to me like in the 20 years since 9/11, a lot of people have started to attempt to get their like daily meaning fix from the onslaught of news, however it is that they are consuming it.
I actually realized that in that same story of my 9/11 morning, after I got out of the Beowulf lecture, I walked into the computer lab, which was a thing.
All 9/11 personal stories eventually resolve into AV stories.
So, and it's true that this was the first major news story that I ever consumed, like in the computer lab. Every screen, all of which were visible from the door, had the same picture. Like the picture of the smoking towers was on every screen from several different news websites. And that actually at the time was a novel way to get news.
Yeah, I think, most people who talk about this talk about the rise of cable news having to do with things like the O.J. Simpson trial and some of the Clinton scandals and whatnot. I think Peter is right that the volume massively increased on 9/11, but the real shift was from cable or from anything on TV to the internet. And you think back, Instapundit, the site now does not mean as much as it used to, but that was, that it launched in August of 2001. It became a major fulcrum of internet everything, of link gathering and a source of community. There was the whole rise of the war blogging community. I think what happened, what 9/11 really poured jet fuel, which we know does not melt structural steel, but it did melt. It did melt news, traditional news networks and cable news pretty well. What happened was, is you had a massive decentralization of the news onto the web with a lot of different voices, often with not very good information, sometimes with really novel and meaningful frames of reference and expertise that were being shut out of traditional news sources. So that was really, fascinating and interesting, but also the rise of the news consumption and production, because this is the moment when everybody became a blogger and everybody became able, either in the comment section or at your own blogger-driven site, which became easier and easier to do, you became a voice and you started to develop your, you began to develop an identity that was based on your vision of the world through the sources of information that you compiled and passed on or participated in. I think we're still working through a lot of that. If anything, I think part of the sadness of the past few years is that a lot of that dispersion and decentralization, that mass personalization and individualization of the news has been clawed back by places like Facebook, weirdly by places like Twitter, which even as they enable people to keep in touch and to reach more and see more, are also putting more and more limits on what is considered acceptable discourse.
Yeah, I mean, I think the one can read into the recent, last year and a half, a proliferation of sub-stacking is kind of a reintroduction of the old blogging model, which was both an embrace of the possibilities of new technology and a reaction to the kind of narrow casted possibilities of what you could see or read or listen to in the media sphere. I mean, I was definitely a participant in the post 9/11 blogging thing. And it actually, my first piece for Reason came, I think, 6 weeks after 9/11. It led to me coming to Reason, which is kind of bizarre if you think about
That's
it.
That's one more thing that we have to blame Al-Qaeda for.
Yeah.
I mean, you're totally right about Substack replicating and in some ways being sort of blogger era 2.0 or 3.0 maybe. But like it's totally returned to that. And literally, the people who dominate the Substack charts are people who, in many cases, made their names in the blogging era and were very good at it. Andrew Sullivan, Matt Taibbi, Matt Iglesias, that's those sorts of folks. The Dispatch is often at the top of the politics charts, and Jonah Goldberg is a founder there. It is very much a return to that model in a lot of ways.
Let's go soon now to our email of the week that I want to get to. But first, are you being held back by depression, stress, anxiety, insomnia, or such like? You can do something about that today. Visit betterhelp.com/roundtable to receive instant confidential access to a network of licensed mental health professionals in all 50 states. Betterhelp.com, that's H-E-L-P, like what Rolling Stone magazine apparently needs to make a phone call, has helped more than 1 million people take control of their own mental health. Listeners to the Roundtable get a special deal, 10%. Off your first month. That's one out of every $10, from what I understand, with other financial aid also available, even though BetterHelp.com is affordable to begin with. Go to the website, BetterHelp.com/roundtable. Describe your issues and your preferred technological methods of delivery, and they'll get you some to talk to within 24 hours. If you don't like that person, you can swap him or her out immediately. Please visit BetterHelp.com today. You'll be glad you did. All right, reminder, keep sending your great emails to roundtable@reason.com with short, pithy questions for the assembled. This one comes from a serial emailer, probably our most frequent emailer, whose name is either Levi or Levy, depending on pronunciation preferences. It goes as follows. Reason frequently makes the case, as it did recently with the Texas abortion law, that, well, if Republicans do X, what's to stop Democrats from also doing X against you? However, I have to ask the following. Is that really a good argument when Democrats are already doing what you claim Republicans should be worried about? For instance, Democrats are already demanding legal liability for gun manufacturers and suing them. Catherine, what say you?
Yeah, I guess I don't see that argument as a causal claim. It's not if you say X is bad, the other side will get to say that they get to do Y. I think it's, and this is actually, to be honest, probably the greatest sort of failing or like cognitive gap between libertarians and other people is that we think people care about being consistent. And people don't. Like, straight up, people do not give one single fuck about being consistent for the most part. People do prefer not to be perceived as hypocrites, though. And so I think that's the mechanism that we're talking about here. The goal is when someone with actual power says A and then not A about their preferred issue and then the thing they want to oppose, sometimes it is helpful to be like, hey, that seems kind of hypocritical or contradictory. Like, sometimes that reduces the chance of a bad outcome happening. And I think, with the Texas abortion stuff, there really is a very long history of Republicans opposing using the kind of mechanisms and thinking that went into the crafting of that particular style of abortion ban. There's a long history of Republicans saying that's bad, bad for the Republic, and will create bad policy. And in fact, when they figured out these particular batch of Texas Republicans figured out how to use it for their own ends, those objections vanished. And that is true of both parties everywhere and always. Of course, individual libertarians are guilty of it, too. But we just seem to care more than other people. And I don't know that it honestly serves us that well, except for maybe to help us sleep at night.
But Nick, isn't it kind of also a question not even of or not only of potential hypocrisy or philosophical consistency, but of power? Like, it's the threat of, hey, dudes, if you're going to pass a law that essentially deputizes the citizenry to go out and make claims against people, that is going to be used against you in ways you don't like.
Yeah, one would hope, and I'm thinking at the national level, during the Obama years, there was, kind of crocodile tears shed by Republicans or conservatives saying, hey, you don't want to give the president this much power after 8 years of Bush, where they were saying, the president should never be questioned on any kind of policy decision, and then Democrats were, when Obama was in power, they were like, hey, he's got a pen and a phone, and that's pretty great, and we should be giving more power to the president or shutting up while he uses it to do whatever he feels like. There was a 15-minute window when it became clear Donald Trump had won the presidency in the 2016 election, where liberals were like, oh, maybe that wasn't a good idea. And so you have this ongoing thing, which actually I think speaks to the reader email, which is any party is right to exercise whatever unbridled power they want the minute they have it, because you don't know that tomorrow is going to come. And I think all of these people are playing with real politics in that sense. I think what libertarians can do to kind of draft a little bit off of what Catherine was saying, people generally may not care about process or procedure or being consistent, but I think by focusing on these types of things and these types of hypocrisies that happen with, alarming frequency, we can start to develop a following for a government that is actually kind of principled in the main, say. By the same token, I think a lot of the times if you get trapped in process questions, or if you start to say, oh, well, what's really bad about the Texas abortion law is that Democrats might use it to go after gun manufacturers, which certainly they will. And in the particular way, well, they'll have private citizens go after gun manufacturers or, you know, things like that. You know, we also need to have an argument and a conversation, you know, and a debate over, you know, is the Texas abortion law, independent of anything else, is it a good or bad law? Is it a legitimate law? I would argue it isn't. The fact that it deputizes people, you know, to launch inquiries, legal inquiries against people based on suspicion. Even people like David French, who is a conservative who is very anti-abortion, says this is bad law. It's a bad law, and it also contravenes, you know, the Supreme Court understanding of the right to an abortion, you know, in the early stages of a pregnancy. So you need to focus on the specifics of the law in the same way that it would be fucked up if the Supreme Court or if legislators said, you know what, yeah, like guns can be used to kill people. So we're going to go after the manufacturers of these devices for legal liability. You know, these are bad laws in and of themselves, and we always need to focus on the actual thing in front of us as well as any implications it might have.
Peter, sounds to me like, once again, David French does nothing. And as part of that, you know, cliche of it, that actually speaks to something that then I think animates a bit of the question, which is that, and also like traces the history of the, you know, people who supported Barack Obama completely forgetting about executive power on, you know, January 23rd, 2009. But that it's about winning now. I mean, that there's a definite correlation between the rise of anti-liberalism, liberalism meaning the broader John Rauch definition of the term, and people just saying, look, I need to exercise my power. That's the most important thing now.
Politics is always about winning, and the job of libertarians and good law is to restrain that. I think that the point of making the argument that, look, you have to consider what the other team would do if they had this power is not so much to say, well, look, that's the explicit reason why we're not going to do this very specific single thing. Instead, it's a thought exercise. It's just designed to make people imagine what would happen if their ideological opponents had the same power and wielded it to ends that you disagree with, right? And so it focuses people on the process. And, you know, Nick might be sort of think, oh, well, like, process concerns are sort of secondary. And I get what he's saying. But I think the mechanisms by which legal force is used are actually really important, because even if Catherine and Nick are right, that people don't really care about those things, by and large, most of the time, good government and fair government actually depend on having those good processes in place. And so those arguments need to be made and need to be sort of kept alive and in the air, even if they're not always persuasive to a lot of people.
Speaking of things that don't get talked about in the same way as they once did in the rememberable past.
Is that a last word?
It just is. Just became one. You're welcome. We like to highlight important pieces of news that are no longer covered that much because there's not as much political fighting over it. One of those happened last week when the trustees of our federal old age entitlement systems came out with a new report about just how soon the trust funds, did you hear the air quotes, of Social Security and Medicare will not have enough funds left in them sooner rather than later. Peter, can you walk us through those mathematics?
Oh, yeah. So we're going to assume for the purposes of this answer that the trust funds are real, which is not necessarily a good assumption. But for the purposes of discussing a report about the financial health of the trust funds, it's a useful starting place. And so the big takeaway to me is that Medicare's big hospital insurance trust fund is going to be insolvent in 5 years. What is going to happen in 5 years? Between now and 5 years from now, we're going to have exactly one presidential election, which means that whoever is in the White House 5 years from now, whoever wins the next presidential election is going to face off with Medicare not being able to pay all of its bills. Now, this is not the same as being completely broke and not able to spend any money at all. But for the hospital insurance trust fund, which covers like inpatient care, basically stuff that you like stuff that gets done inside a hospital. Medicare is only going to be able to pay about 91% of its bills starting in 5 years. And that might sound like, oh, well, they're going to be able to pay most of them. That's fine. Right? That's not a big deal. No, if imagine taking a 9% pay cut. Now imagine every hospital worker in the country taking effectively a 9% pay cut. Yeah, there's private insurance. It's not, it's like there's complications here. But just for, again, for simplification purposes, that's a gigantic deal. And hospitals are going to lobby to fix this somehow or another. There's going to be a sort of political campaigns about this. But what's really amazing is this is just not being talked about as a national political issue. In fact, Joe Biden right now and Democrats in Congress, who, by the way, control both the House and the Senate, as you may remember, they are working towards, by the end of this year, a plan to expand Medicare. They're actually going to add benefits to Medicare. Dental, vision, a bunch of other stuff. And it's going to cost an awful lot of money. So they're going to spend a whole bunch of money to make Medicare bigger and more expansive, even though Medicare is going to be insolvent in 5 years, a problem that they are not talking about and not dealing with at all. And it's really just remarkable how much of a non-issue Medicare's looming insolvency has become in federal politics. Republicans are barely talking about this. And I blame in many ways Donald Trump, who just sort of literalized the practical position of many, sort of the quiet practical position of many Republican politicians in the pre-Trump era. But Trump basically just said flatly, we will not cut old age entitlements, Medicare and Social Security. That is not on the table. We're not going to do it. And so if you're not going to cut it, then you got two choices. You can either let Medicare effectively cut itself, which is what insolvency is, right? It's a, like I said, a 9% cut for all of those hospital payments. Or you can say, we're going to raise taxes or open up general fund revenue to start paying for this some other way. And my suspicion here is that the way this goes is that Congress will just sort of get together and grumble about this for a little while, and then we'll open up the HI, the Hospital Insurance Trust Fund, to be able to draw from general revenues. That means that instead of just being able to draw from the Medicare Trust Fund, they'll be able to take from the whole rest of the budget without any sort of limits. In one sense, that fixes the problem of not having a dedicated funding stream for Medicare, but it doesn't fix the underlying problem, which is that Medicare's costs are rapidly increasing, and this is going to be a huge, huge drain on taxpayers that nobody is suggesting nobody has any solution to, and nobody's even talking about solutions to. And so, I mean, you can just look at the other trust fund there just very quickly, right? So there's a second big Medicare trust fund, and it is adequately financed into the indefinite future, as the trustees report says, because current law provides financing from general revenues. But then they also say the rapid growth of its costs will place steadily increasing demands on both taxpayers and beneficiaries for years to come here. And so the plan here, so far as anybody has one, is basically just to let let Medicare increase in costs forever and not really ever deal with that problem or do anything about it.
Yeah, for old age and old age entitlements, which include Social Security, the main retirement fund for people, which also is facing a similar kind of reckoning in the early 2030s, and exactly
insolvency
when varies.
In about 12 years, and that's been moved up a year in this report.
Go ahead, Nick.
But what is coming in all of this, because it's not just Donald Trump, Mitt Romney, famously, I mean, he campaigned against Obamacare partly because he said it was going to rob money from Medicare and other old age entitlement programs and things like that, as has every Republican and every Democrat since we've been alive, to be quite honest. I mean, Matt and I guess, are old enough, Social Security or Medicare was not fully operational during our early years. But since then, what is going to happen is that taxes are going to be raised. Payroll taxes will be raised. This is something that Ronald Reagan did in the late 80s as part of a big tax simplification program. And he bragged about it. This is Ronald Reagan, the man who, who had campaigned in the early 60s for Barry Goldwater, saying Medicare was socialized medicine and it should be gotten rid of, that Social Security should be voluntary and things like that. By the end of his presidency, he bragged that he had raised payroll taxes massively in order to protect Social Security and Medicare for another generation. And he considered that, in his own estimation, the biggest accomplishment of his presidency. We're going to start hearing a lot of that rhetoric, you know, starting anytime soon, because what is coming, the easiest way to fix all of this is not to cut payments. As Peter was saying, there's a, you know, an absolutely awful record of trying to cut any payments in the Medicare system. They always get preserved somehow. Who can get squeezed are taxpayers, and expect, you know, the couple percent on FICA tax that you pay specifically for Medicare, as well as the, you know, 14% or so, or 12% or so that you pay for Social Security, those are going to go up. And that's the battle. And that's actually something worth fighting for, because these are places where we've seen this at the state level. And Reason Foundation, the policy think tank affiliated with that's also promoted or run by, funded by Reason Foundation, that publishes our website, our magazine, our podcast. They've done great work on privatizing pensions for public sector employees at the state level. We need to start coming up with a way where we shift Social Security and Medicare from entitlements, open-ended entitlements for people who don't need them, for wealthy people, for expanded and constantly increasing entitlement payments, to something different than that. And that is the conversation that we need to, or the policy discussion that needs to get kickstarted. And it's really hard to, because politicians know what they have a strategy. They're going to wait until the house is burned down and then say, we're going to have to hit you up for a few more percentage points in order to rebuild.
Catherine, is this why we should all become anarchists?
Yep. I think that I have shifted from, you know, I was sort of a classic late Gen X or early millennial, whatever, who just thought, I'm not going to get benefits, right? Like, I'm just not going to get any of these retirement benefits. They're not still going to exist by the time I'm ready to receive them. And my mind has actually changed. I think I probably will get them. And that's horrible. Like, what Peter said is right. We will just fund them out of general funds. We will just spend more money we don't have. We will incur more debt that we can't afford the interest payments on. And I guess I'm just going to get benefits until the system collapses and then no one gets anything, is where we're at now. In conclusion, be an anarchist.
Let's go to our end of podcast, what we have been consuming in the cultural sphere, in which the Reason Roundtable participants speak concisely about what they have been consuming in the cultural sphere. Catherine, do you want to lead by example, please?
Sure. I decided that it was time for me to read the new Jane Austen novel. I know what you're thinking. How is there a new Jane Austen novel, you might be asking? I thought that she was dead. She is. But there has long been known to exist a couple of fragments. One of them is called Sanditon. It is a it turns out a very short sketch of the book that Austen was working on when she died. I have gotten back into the habit of going to the public library, even though I am an anarchist, and this was sitting on the front table, so I grabbed it. It was a mistake, friends, because here's what I read this weekend. I read a novelization of the BBC adaptation of the Austen fragment. It was pretty bad. It was basically Bridgerton. There was like incest and, you know, gambling rakes, and it was not the subtle beauty that one expects from Jane Austen. And I will say that the reason I was optimistic about it is because it is actually it is a book about what happens when the landed gentry attempts to be entrepreneurial. So this is about like trying to establish essentially a tourist town out of nothing, out of a fishing village. There's also a black character, which Austen did herself write, which is sort of interesting. A lot of promise, absolutely no delivery. Do not recommend.
What's the black character? Where do they come from?
She's from Antigua. And she is an heiress. So we basically have this idea of, you know, if we have a bunch of idiots who don't know how to do commerce and they have varying amounts of like title and money, and then someone happens in their midst who has a tremendous amount of money, but they are sort of the limits of pairing together someone with cash and someone with a title are sort of tested by the fact that she is, I think she is described in the original Austen manuscript as half mulatto, which is not even exactly clear what that means. But needless to say, this is a warning, not a recommendation. The Kate Riordan novelization of Jane Austen's fragment, Sanditon, is not good.
So when the next printing comes out, is it going to have the quote, basically Bridgerton in giant font on the cover?
Absolutely. And I should have been clued in by the photo on the cover, which is just, a photo of like the BBC adaptation in which the lady looks too schmancy.
Nick, do you have a warning or a recommendation for us?
I have two recommendations. One, and they are the bases of my or the two most recent interview podcasts. One that went out last week with Stephen Wertheim, and one that's coming out tomorrow with Spencer Ackerman. But Wertheim's book is Tomorrow the World, The Birth of U.S. Global Supremacy. It came out last fall. And it is a really great historic account of how the U.S. right before and then during and after World War II, how the wise men decided that internationalism was synonymous with the projection of massive military force. And particularly for libertarians, one of the most interesting things about it will be discussion of isolationism. Nobody in the 30s was calling themselves an isolationist, and many of the people who have been kind of slagged with that phrase were in fact super internationalists who were saying that the United States after World War II and in the face of rising totalitarianism needed to be more actively engaged in the world through commerce and through travel and through politics and diplomacy. They were just like, you know, it would be really stupid to think that we could accomplish a lot of things through massive military might. It would be a drain on us and it wouldn't solve anything. Those in most cases were slagged as isolationists in favor of people who were like, you know what, we have an opportunity to really kind of run the world on our terms through our garrison stationed all over the place. So it's an essential kind of pretext for 20th century into 21st century American foreign policy. And Wertheim he had been at the Quincy Institute, the think tank that had been co-founded on non-interventionist foreign policy, co-funded by people like George Soros and the Koch brothers. So it's a whole new level of supervillain team-up going on. That book is an essential pretext to why we got into Afghanistan the way we did and why we stayed so long and why we tacked on Iraq and Yemen and everything else. And then the other book that kind of closes this out is Reign of Terror, How 9/11 Destabilized America and Produced Trump by Spencer Ackerman. And what's particularly good about this book, and for those of us who remember this period, you are reminded again and again of all of these horrible stories of the ways in which, as Peter was talking about, the Bush administration was either incompetent or in certain ways pure evil in the way that they valorized torture and the destruction of human life adjacent to people they thought were trying to destroy us and things like that. It is really a powerful recreation of the mania that was ushered in for the better part of a decade by Democrats and Republicans, liberals and conservatives, that gave us the war on terror and the way that that kind of reframed and refreshened a Cold War superpower struggle that was done, but put it into the context of a war on terror. So Tomorrow the World and Reign of Terror are my recommendations, and they are warnings as well, but definitely check out both of those books.
Peter, what's latest extrusion of the Marvel Cinematic Universe are you going to tell us about?
So I do not have two recommendations, but I have two thumbs, and I'm going to put them both up for Shang-Chi and the Legend of the Ten Rings. It's
fact
fun!
Check. Both thumbs are, in fact, up.
They are, because it's fun. It's a Marvelized riff on Asian martial arts films, draws a lot from Zhang Yimou films like House of Flying Daggers and Curse of the Golden Flower. It's really quite pretty to look at in a lot of ways, and it delivers a lot of character information through its action scenes. But it also draws a lot from Jackie Chan movies. In fact, a bunch of the Jackie Chan action scene veterans designed a bunch of the action scenes here, and there are explicit shout-outs to Rumble in the Bronx and Rush Hour 2. So the action is light and fun, not self-serious and gritty, as you sometimes get in some of these movies. I would also just say, this is not a big lift for people who have not kept up with the MCU. There are some references, sure, and it probably helps to have seen Doctor Strange. But if you have not seen really any other MCU films, or you are behind, you haven't seen the latest episode of What If or Loki, you are basically going to get all of this. There's a lot to enjoy here. Strongly recommend.
I, in my never-ending quest both to see classic movies that everybody else has seen and to elicit scoffs of derision from Nick Gillespie.
Can we guess what classic movie you've seen?
You probably wouldn't guess this one, but
Bridge
go ahead
on the
and
River
try.
I bet it's Gone with
I've
the
seen
Wind.
That one. You know what I had? If that wasn't so long, that would go into my queue of classic movies that I have actually never seen. And also, I don't want to watch that. I watched the 1953 film by Billy Wilder, Stalag 17, have heard so much about over the years and just never watched it. It is the template for Hogan's Heroes.
And Hogan's Heroes is much better than it, don't you think? Both on a pathos as well as just comedy level. It's better.
The comedy in Stalag 17 is pretty weird. So it's a prison camp movie. Obviously, Americans, World War II, with semi-buffoonish but also murderous, German prison guards. And the conceit is that... it starts off with a couple of American prisoners trying to escape. A spoiler alert from a 1953 movie. They get shot. And then it's who is the person inside this barracks who is leaking out to the commandant. And that's the tension of the movie. And it's a slapstick kind of movie featuring just the great ethnic stereotypes from New York and just the drooling animal figure who just wants, I think, Doris Day over and over again, kissing the poster and a little wisecracking friend and everything. And it's pretty weird to watch in 2021 eyes to see this, even though I guess the Jojo Rabbit movie, which I did see, also kind of mixes essences of slapstick. But what I learned in reading about Stalag 17 is that was faithful to the play. It wasn't just some like a Billy Wilder add-on. There was a play written by guys who went into a similar prison camp, and they played it up for laughs in 1951 on Broadway as well. William Holden is the Hogan. No, is Hogan the guy in the Hogan's Hero? I forget. Yeah. So like the brown leather jacket, and he kind of is the wise cracking insider who everyone suspects of being the leak. Turns out he's going to be the hero at the end. Really great, interesting movie, and just kind of weird to handle the tonality of it. And man, these old movies, they had long scenes. Boy, those scenes are long.
Like bad just long, super right?
Long, painfully too long.
Like they'd it's better.
This
now.
One thing. Wait, so you're this was living in a world where 9/11 Marvel Comics goes on for 20 hours.
This was before 9/11 changed news consumption, and people assumed that things that like information would come at you slowly, and it would be organized, and it would take its time.
I'm pro 9/11 now.
I like me some long shots and stoner Stanley Kubrick movies. I'm with it. But man, this is just like, here's the guys going to be like doing a little march around a table.
They all
for
have
four
shtick.
Minutes.
In old movies,
they
people just
all do their shtick, man.
In old movies, people just be walking across the room. Like we just watch them walk across. It's horrible.
What I want to know is,
you know, it's a long day in Stalag 17. You know, what's the rush?
You have to have seen Stalag 1 through 16 to understand it.
Yeah. Thankfully, no. It's immediately accessible. I do recommend it. It's great,
you know,
and it's fun, and Nick is ultimately right. That Hogan's Heroes is the superior product.
One of the great elements of that, though, Matt, too, and it fits in with a lot of other things, including novels and movies like From Here to Eternity, and the best years of our lives is that the cynicism and the darkness of the greatest generation, when they were actually producing culture as opposed to being lionized by baby boomers right the minute after they dropped dead in the late 90s, is bracing and is worth recovering. Because, yeah, you know, these were people who went through the Depression and World War II and everything after that. And they were not, you know, happy-go-lucky, cheery people. They were dark, engaged, interesting people who criticized power. Because through all of this stuff, it's actually the cynicism towards the elites, whether they're Nazis or American, you know, allied generals, is really powerful and worth recovering.
I never, until this moment, Nick, understood that our greatest 20th century hero, Bugs Bunny, is ultimately a greatest generation avatar.
Right down to his tricksterism, cynicism, and you know, gallows humor.
And defiance of authority. All right, that's all the authority defiance we have time for here on the Reason Roundtable podcast. Thank you for listening to us on a Tuesday. Because I know you listen to it straight away and listen to all of podcasts, including the ones that Nick was teasing up later on this week. We'll catch you next week. Goodbye.